Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Richard Florida is with us now, author of the highly influential book, The Rise of the Creative Class. That book has just been revised for a 10th anniversary edition, which argues that a creative class compact should be a key to bringing back jobs. Richard Florida is a management professor jointly appointed now at the University of Toronto and at NYU here in New York. Plus, he's a senior editor at The Atlantic and author of The Rise of the Creative Class. Hi, Richard. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be here with you again today.
Big picture first. You see the sweep of history as taking us from the old industrial economy to what you call an emerging creative economy. Why do you use that term?
Well, I'm happy with a variety of terms. You know, people have talked about the shift to a post-industrial economy or an information age or a knowledge age or a service age, a technology age. The reason I came to the word creative after reviewing all of that and seeing the merit in all of those constructs is when I really thought about what makes human beings the same. You know, people like Marx and other classical economists and philosophers had thought when people use their physical labor, Marx said that's what created a working class that was a universal class, using their physical labor to transform nature and build things and grow an economy. I was really asking the question, what in a knowledge economy or innovation economy, it's not the knowledge that we acquire, it's not the information or innovations we produce, it's really the creativity that human beings share. So when I looked at the psychologists who studied this, they said really what makes human beings different from other species is that we can act creatively, intellectually, physically, and through all of the ways we work and do things. So that's how I came to this idea that creativity is key in understanding our modern economy.
To be clear, when you talk about the creative class or a creative economy, you don't just mean writers and actors. How broad is your definition of the creative class?
Well, that's another reason I wanted to do the 10th anniversary edition, and Basic Books asked me to do the 10th anniversary edition, because a lot of people, when they heard the word creative class, thought it was artists and musicians and graphic designers. Though I added them to the category of knowledge workers. I think they're critically important, but it includes scientists, technologists, engineers, and people who are entrepreneurial and innovative. It includes management professionals, the kinds of people Peter Drucker and others had called the canonical, you know, the dyed-in-the-wool knowledge worker. It also includes the artists, media workers, entertainers. And what's interesting is when I went back and looked at the information, we're actually able to look inside this group, this creative economy group or creative class group. We found that three groups of workers really add value to regional economies, lots of value. Obviously, scientists and engineers, kind of a no-brainer. Business and management, if you have scientists and engineers and you combine them with good business and management, you get a Silicon Valley. But also, we found, quite to our surprise, that the artists and entertainers and designers and musicians weren't just an add-on, that actually they were the third group that added a lot of regional economic wealth. So I like the idea.
Because of the quality of life that they bring that attracts the managers and the scientists?
I think it's a twofold. I think there's clearly an indirect effect that places that are vibrant. Obviously, one of the things I've been writing about and studying a lot is the shift of technology back to urban centers. You know, who would have thought that New York City or London or even downtown San Francisco would be generating and attracting not only Google's but their own startups.
Pittsburgh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh, where I lived for 20 years and we worked hard on that. And even it's very happy, although there's a lot more to go, even Detroit. It's starting to move back to downtown Detroit. But one of the things we found is if you think about it, with this new technology shift – in the old days, if you invented a semiconductor or a software or a new biotechnology, that was kind of the defining act. But now it seems to me that the best technologies are combining good ideas and good inventions with arts, culture, you know, software and hardware, content and technology. But also, I think the key fact is you need good managers. And, you know, people don't really want to talk about that because it's a creative class. But I think if you look at – we've been studying musical bands. Uh-huh. If you look at the most successful musical bands – or even the most successful artist, there's a lot of people with talent, but usually the most successful bands are able to use management and technology to their advantage. The same thing with the most successful technology firms like Apple. They make great use of arts and design to make distinctive products. So I think it's a blending of arts, technology, and management that kind of fuels this creative economy.
So dare I say that the creative class, by your definition, would include most people who work on Wall Street and the leaders of the Occupy movement?
Yes. Yes, it would, by my definition. And one of the things I think that Tom Philippon at NYU and others have been working on is that, unfortunately, in this country, and it was, you had a great segment, our banks got way, 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 way too influential. You know, banks, provision of capital are important, but they got way too influential. And I think it's a good thing that we're stepping back, and whether we break up the banks or re-regulate them. It was interesting to hear, sorry, about Canada, because I live in Toronto. And boy, you can really feel the difference when the banks play their role as a member of a knowledge economy, rather when they go off on their own and try to just try to generate rents or generate their own returns without being attached to the real or creative economy.
You want to talk a little bit more about that? What is the role of the banks in Canada compared to the United States?
Well, TD, you know, it's so funny to see a Canadian bank on every street corner in New York. And I don't know, I used to see Regis Philbin doing those advertisements, but really, they're very well managed. I think that's the first thing that you notice, that the whole customer service orientation is terrific. But the banks are really like they were in the U.S. when I was a boy. They are part of providing capital. They hold your mortgage. They don't trade your mortgage like a security. So the bank that you have a mortgage. Another thing that's really odd for an American is you can't refinance your mortgage crazily. Like if you have a long-term mortgage, you agree to an interest rate. Maybe after 7 years you can redo it, but you have to pay a penalty. So the risk is shared. And I think the banks have become a much better partner in building the real economy and obviously mitigating risk. You know, it's sad that in contemporary capitalism, which has so many assets, you know, creativity, knowledge, innovation, that we let our banks and our banking system and our financial system go out of such control and take so much risk. So one of the things I wrote in Rise of the Creative Class Revisited is I think we're getting back to building our real economy. And the real way to build that real economy is to invest in people's creativity, people's inventiveness, entrepreneurial firms, and importantly, the cities and communities where we live.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Richard Florida, author of the 10th anniversary edition of The Rise of the Creative Class, called The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. We can take your phone calls for those of you who've read or heard Richard Florida in the past or are just hearing him for the first time now on any of this, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or you can post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So you see three basic economic classes in the United States today, the creative class, as we've just been describing, and what you call the working class and the service class. Are they not the same thing? Aren't today's service workers today's working class?
In a way, they are. But, you know, if you go back to Marx, the workers were the people who worked in the factories, and they were different than the people who worked on the farms, you know, the feudal classes. So I think what's sad and tragic, as the son of a factory worker, my dad worked in the factory in Newark, New Jersey, across the river. I think what's sad is the working class jobs have declined. Less than 20, almost about 20% of our workforce does working class blue collar jobs. But that includes people who move things, you know, UPS workers and FedEx workers and moving workers. That includes people who build things, construction workers who are very blue collar. Only 6% of Americans actually touch products and make physical products. And when I looked at the data, that's about the same amount as were involved in agriculture in 1930 or 1940. So it's really declining quite. And some of that's coming back, and that's a good thing. But we're not going to push the needle up too much further. We have two big classes. One are the knowledge workers, which are the creatives, the knowledge workers, the artists, the engineers, what I call the creative class. That's about 40 million Americans who are doing pretty well. Even in the recession, their rate of unemployment never topped 5%. Now, some artists were hard hit, and some journalists were obviously hard hit, and some people who worked in finance were hard, managers were hard hit, and that's tragic. But compared to the national rate of more than 10% and the work rate for manufacturing workers of nearly 20%, it didn't. And the salary range is about 70 grand. The service workers are the class I've become more. That's my big learning after 10 years, Brian, and for folks listening in. 65 million Americans who are working, taking care of our kids, taking care of our parents, serving us our food, working in retail shops, taking care of our lawns, giving us manicures, giving us haircuts. You can go on and on and on. Those people work in the most contingent work. Their jobs are the least secure. They make 20 grand or 30 grand if they're lucky. Their rates of unemployment skyrocketed. You know, those families are working two and three jobs to survive. And one of the things I wanted to articulate in this book, and that's why I added two new chapters on this in growing inequality and the class divide, is I think as a country and as cities, we have to take this seriously. Because if we can't elevate this class and make it, you know, your point was so well taken, if we can't make the service class like the working class was, this class divide and inequality in our society is just going to get deeper and deeper and become a terrible prolonged problem for us.
And so your number one proposal in the revisited edition of The Rise of the Creative Class is to transform low-paying service sector jobs into jobs that pay a family wage, enough to raise kids on. So if you want a pay hike for these workers you were just mentioning, home health aide, food service workers, people who work in stores, if that's not what the market bears for those jobs, how do you attain it?
Well, I think there's three things. One, I think it's part of when your previous guest was talking about Canada being the – and you said it – Canada being the one stable place. We pay service workers more. I pay more for a haircut to get our house painted or have a cleaning person come. We pay more. But we don't have the class divide, and you don't feel the anxiety, and you don't feel – you feel cohesive. Don't get me wrong. Canada has plenty of divides. We can go into another show. But you don't feel what you feel in the United States. I said a couple things. One, big cities do pay service workers better. Where service workers locate around robust economies like this one, their wages are higher. Now, unfortunately, the housing costs are higher. And whilst the knowledge worker can make enough to afford the housing, the service worker, even though the wages are up, doesn't make enough. The two things I proposed in my book and then in that little op-ed I wrote for the Daily News, I said, I think the city itself should begin to organize the service companies and maybe call together a summit. I'd love to hear Seth. I talked to Seth. He's going to be a guest. I talked to Seth about this.
Seth Pinsky, the head of the Economic Development Corporation of New York City, who's going to be on here tomorrow. Go ahead.
I think what Seth and what Bob Steele and Howard Wolfson and the mayor are doing is phenomenal, and I'm glad to be coming here and be more a part of it. But I think one part of it is getting more entrepreneurship, and I think Seth understands this. And one of the things we found is in technology fields, where they added – gave technologists management skills to run those high-tech businesses and formed incubation programs. They became more successful. We can do that for service businesses. A large part of the businesses, as Seth will say, are these mom-and-pop local businesses. One thing we could do is use our training infrastructure, community colleges, neighborhood organizations, to help those businesses get more management and marketing and business planning skills. But the bigger one, we actually got it started under Toronto, under the former mayor, David Miller, who's actually also teaching at NYU these days, which is pretty funny. We organized a Strength in Services Summit, and we brought together leading-age service companies with unions and civic leaders to say what I propose in the book. If you engage service workers in their work, if you do what you did in manufacturing and form work teams, engage them in continuous improvement, what the studies find is those service workers not only get higher wages, they become more engaged, and they lead to better innovations and more productivity. So you can get a win-win. And I think that's the conversation. We don't have all the answers, none of us. But if we're going to upgrade work, 60 million jobs, 50% of our workforce is where we've got to start to do hard work to improve those jobs.
So before we take a break, just to kind of tie a bow on that thought, you take a position on this contemporary debate between a high-wage, high-price society and a low-wage, low-prices society. In other words, you reject the Walmart model that the middle class is helped more by low prices than it's hurt by low wages.
Yes. And I think, when we look back in history, I keep thinking about the Depression, because my dad and my uncles told me all the war stories from it. But, a fellow like Henry Ford, like him or not, said if we're gonna have a strong country and people are going to buy cars, we have to pay the workers more. And people like Edward Filene, the great retailer, said if you're going to sell stuff in Filene's store and then Filene's basement, people have to have income. And then FDR and the unions and our society agreed. My dad, when he started work in 1934, there were 9 people in his family to make 1 family wage in Newark, New Jersey. When my dad returned from World War II, when the social compacts was forged, when our unionization occurred, when we decided that we would build a society, we decided we would pay more for cars and steel and eyeglasses so that workers could earn more, so we could have a middle class, so they could buy products and our society can grow. Yeah, I think it's incumbent on us to have a conversation about how to upgrade the wages and productivity and innovation and skills of our low-wage service workers and build a stronger society.
Our lines are jammed. We'll take some of the phone calls in a minute for Richard Florida, author of The Rise of the Creative Class, Revisited. I also noticed that you've commented with a map about the geography of gun deaths on the intersection between your creative class theories and the Aurora massacre of all things. So we'll get to that too. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Uh-huh.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Richard Florida. His 10th anniversary edition of The Rise of the Creative Class is just out. And Jim in the Bronx, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a number of problems with your author beginning with this misunderstanding of Marx, but what I really think he has to consider is how any of his agenda can be enacted politically. You have to remember there's a very deeply entrenched and erroneous view that free markets are the solution to everything in the society by libertarians and these kinds of people. How can you take on that idea first before you can come up with an alternative agenda for the type of policies he's advocating? I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thank you.
Hey, Jim. It'd be great. We could engage on the whole question of Marx. You know, you could email me or send me on Twitter, florida@creativeclass.com. I'd be happy to pick up that conversation. I unfortunately agree with you. I don't know if you're going to like my answer, but I made a decision that really the power of markets and capitalism and a narrative about economic growth was the best way to help reform or make our society better. I think it is so deeply entrenched in people's values and the way our country's led that it's hard for me to imagine an alternative path. So I think you're right that I try to make arguments that are in light of using a market society, reforming a market society, making markets work better for people. I think that's been the trajectory of the American experience, that the American experience has been of one of reforming markets. And I'm nervous. I'm being quite honest with you, Jim, because I think your question's so well taken. I'm nervous of major revolutionary experiments. Most times – I've read this history pretty closely – if you look at the Soviet Union and others, even China, they didn't turn out all that great. And maybe a more modest path towards reform, like has happened in Sweden or Canada, I think the United States could use more reform, or other Northern European countries, strikes me as a better path. But I appreciate your sentiment.
But he raises the question, too, of political feasibility. And you write about that. You describe the politics of our current class system, including this paradox that while richer Americans tend to vote Republican and poorer ones tend to vote Democratic, richer states tend to be blue and poorer states tend to be red. Explain that.
Well, that's the fantastic work of Andrew Gelman at Columbia University in his book, Rich State, Poor State, Red State, Blue State, which is just a primer on our political system. You know, I actually lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years, and I tried to get involved in national affairs and continue to be a big supporter of the president. I think we all agree that the Washington system is dysfunctional, the Congress and all of that. Where I think the opportunities for action and reform are is at the local level. Ben Barber, the distinguished political theorist, is writing a book. I interviewed on him. He called it "If Mayors Ruled the World." I wish I had. That's one title I wish I had. Huh. But what Ben is saying and what I agree with.
And Ben is great. Another frequent guest here.
Yeah, I think it's the mayor level. It's the Mike Bloomberg level. It's the Rahm Emanuel level. It's the former mayor Manny Diaz in Miami, former mayor John Hinkenlooper in Denver. It's the mayor level that I think you can see action being taken that is pragmatic and oriented to growing an economy in a more equitable way. So that's where I've concentrated my effort. But I think the class divide in our politics at the national level is almost impenetrable for me.
Anderson in Queens, you're on WNYC with Richard Florida. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to bring up an example of Brazil, for example, that is doing exactly what the guest is saying. It's been, for the past 10 years, 15 years actually, Brazil has been investing heavily on social programs that, and also education, more money for all levels of education, bringing, so event, now, for the, you know, we are seeing results now in Brazil of real results of people going up on the ladder of, on a socialist ladder of becoming having a higher incomes, going to professions that they never thought they could be doing. For example, house cleaners, housekeepers. It's becoming very difficult in São Paulo and Rio to find one because they are becoming business owners, they're opening hair salons, they're opening cleaning companies, and these are usually people in their 30s and 40s, even their 50s. So when people are given the chance to improve themselves, they will grab that chance, and salaries increase, and malls in Brazil are packed all the time. I was there a month ago, and People are buying everything and all over the place. So there's a very, very active economy that's being driven to the increase of this 30 million people that are, you know, coming out of poverty.
Anderson, thank you so much. And, of course, we compare ourselves these days more and more to the so-called BRIC countries that are growing as we're stagnating. BRIC for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. One morsel in that call that seemed consistent with something that you said before. He almost seemed to be suggesting that people who had been maids are starting cleaning businesses, and now they're entrepreneurs and they can charge more money.
Yeah, I think that's happening, and I think we've seen it in, you know, I have a very good friend in Toronto who was a makeup artist and a hairstylist and started a tiny little company called MAC Cosmetics, and it was an activist company on AIDS and gay rights and did a number of good and made a lot of money and paid good salaries and treated people reasonably. Yes, I think upgrading the service businesses, talking when you talk with Seth Pinsky about how we can encourage entrepreneurship, all the things, you know, people call it precious. But all the stuff that's gone on in Brooklyn, you know, and everybody can poke fun and be snarky, but young people upgrading traditional trades like barbering and distilling, and I think these are really ways to add value and take not great jobs and make them better jobs. But the point about Brazil is the key one Anderson makes. I actually look at the BRICS and see them very differently. I don't see them as a homogenous group. India also reflects a creative but China and Russia to me are top-down systems. They don't incubate a lot of creativity. They haven't formed a lot of powerful startup companies. India is a creative economy, but if I look at an economy that's really creative in music, you know, there aren't many countries that can touch the African-American ethnic musical experience in the United States, but Brazil is one of them. A style, you know, a Brazilian style, fashion, beachwear, food, innovations in food. And I think that applying that kind of innovative mentality, that's what what Anderson was saying, making traditional work better work, adding innovation to it. And you know what I think it could do? It could actually make a city more productive. You know, our manufacturing companies run 24/7. They're very productive. Our knowledge companies are pretty productive and high-tech companies. Our service companies are terribly fractured and unproductive. If we can make the service economy, 50% of our workforce, more productive and higher wages, it will make our cities and communities and countries more productive.
Before you go, the geography of gun deaths. It's a chart that I guess you have on The Atlantic.
Yes, and on Atlantic Cities, our sister site, which is specifically about cities and urban areas.
And what does it have to do with the movie theater massacre?
Well, it's something I confronted in the book, which really disturbed me. When I applied this class divide of creative versus service and working, and I looked at everything from health statistics, smoking and obesity, levels of happiness and well-being, but gun violence. I looked at this for the book and for The Atlantic previously. Rates of death by firearm. Now, that includes, it's not just mass murder. It includes a killing. It includes a suicide. Any place somebody's killed with a gun. This is coming from someone who's never held a gun. What I found was red states have many more of them. More religious states have many more of them. But knowledge-based, higher-earning, creative-class states have many fewer. And states which are poorer and more blue-collar and more working class have many more. And I talk about in that piece the classic articles that have been written on this culture of honor. You know, I guess I grew up as an Italian-American New Jersey in a culture of honor. Somebody crossed you, you fought. And that's what these fellows were talking about in southern states, in lower-income states, in states where people don't have other outlets. When a young person, particularly a young man, gets insulted in this working class, blue collar, you know, in this culture, they're more likely to get violent with people, and the gun just makes it terrible. But there is a class dimension to this.
But it's also the coastal creative class cities like New York that still also have an urban underclass, if that's the right term, where there's a lot of, you know, retail, old-fashioned street gun violence, not just red southern states with some kind of old-fashioned violence.
No, and we have actually experienced this for the first time in Toronto, a city that had never been beset by gun violence, right? A couple of weeks before Aurora, there was a killing in one of our malls. So, boy, I think the other thing I found, just for folks listening in, there is a class element, but gun control. Now, this is looking at states, not individuals, not individual killings. So please, it has to be taken in context. Gun control works. We found strong correlations between state with stricter gun restrictions and lower levels of gun violence. So I have to support the mayor on this and what he's doing. We need stricter gun control in this country.
Well, that's not where I thought we would wind up this discussion.
But it's fun anyway.
It's been a fascinating discussion with Richard Florida, who this semester will be teaching at the University of Toronto and NYU in a joint appointment. He's senior editor for The Atlantic and now author of the 10th anniversary edition of The Rise of the Creative Class. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why some New York neighborhoods have slower internet than others. Stay with us.